This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across the state of North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to talk about something that is rather unusual in North Dakota, which is a very tall building. As a matter of fact, a very tall building in the middle of the state's biggest city. And we're going to talk with Derek Heshen. He is the general manager of McGough Construction, which is the prime contractor for this structure. And Keith Lear is the project manager. He's with Kilbourne Group, one of the principals behind this project. Keith, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Give us a brief overview of what Block 9 is.
So, so Block 9 is a project that's three quarters of a city block. So there's three main components of the project. We have a parking ramp. We have the mixed-use tower. The tower itself is 235 feet tall. It's got seven different uses inside of it, but the main tenants are RDO's corporate headquarters.
RDO Offutt, which is a big John Deere
correct, yeah.
dealership.
Right, so RDO Offutt Company is bringing their regional a few regional offices, consolidating those into one location, and that'll be in this building. We have a 125-room boutique hotel in this building. There's some additional office space and a couple of residential condos in the space as well. So that's kind of the main building. And then the plaza, a public plaza associated with this as well. So that public plaza being a community asset, kind of a living room for downtown Fargo, programmed year-round with, we think, at least 150 events a year, outdoor music, movies, ice skating rink, all kinds of things going on in that plaza as well.
You mentioned it's 235 feet tall. The state capitol in Bismarck, the skyscraper on the prairie, as it's known, is 242 feet tall. So this is pretty big building. And the Radisson Hotel, which we're connected to by a skyway, is a little bit shorter, I take it.
Right, yeah. So I think the Radisson's right around 205 or 207, so we'll be slightly taller than the Radisson.
And we should also mention that Prairie Public will have its station to transmitter links on top of this new tower when it's finally done. Or excuse me, the Radisson.
The Radisson, when it's finally correct. Done. Yep, the Radisson.
Derek, you're the general manager for McGough Construction. Tell us a little bit about your company.
Sure. McGough Construction is a family-owned, privately held company. We're based out of St. Paul. There's six generations of the McGoughs that founded the company. We work all over the upper Midwest, in Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, down in Dallas as well, and Phoenix. We're a general contractor, so not only do we run construction projects, but we also build them as well. We have over 450 craftsmen in our company. That's carpenters and laborers and cement masons and things of that nature. So on a project like this, we will also self-perform a lot of the work ourselves, as well as subcontract out many of the trades too. So,
well, we should mention that you've done some very significant buildings in the state of Minnesota.
Absolutely, like the Guthrie Theater and some Land O'Lakes projects, and many of the Fortune 500 companies down there. McGough has a long-standing relationships with a lot of the companies in the Twin Cities and throughout Minnesota.
And do you have a diversity plan as well, don't you, in terms of your hiring?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We're an equal opportunity company. We're a yellow ribbon company by the state of Minnesota, and certainly.
Well, let's find out who's in charge here. What's the relationship between the project manager, Kilbourne Group, and the general contractor, McGough Construction?
So, yeah, so from the partnership that's developing the project, we would be considered the ownership group of the project, that's the RDO Offutt Company and Kilbourne Group. So together we make Block 9 partners, and we're the group that's developing and overseeing the project. So we've hired McGough Construction as our general contractor for the project. So they oversee all the construction aspects of it, hiring all the subcontractors, coordinating the work, and ultimately building this project.
We have to say that our offices here at Prairie Public look right at the Block 9 site. I mean, I'm looking right down at the hole right now every day, and I've seen these huge construction cranes go up, so it's a lot of eye candy for those of us who work downtown. What did McGough Construction have to do to get this contract?
So ultimately, there's an interview process that goes along with this project. So when we're getting closer to construction, we send out a set of documents associated with the contract documents for the project. They'll put together an estimate to give us a range for the value of the project. And then they'll come in and they'll do an interview. They'll provide a very lengthy proposal process talking about safety records, company history, the team that's proposed on this project, and the amount of experience they have in these types of builds. So we come through, we have a very long interview process. There's a lot of back and forth discussion as we start to vet things out. But ultimately, we make a decision on the best value contractor that can be on this project. So it's not necessarily bottom dollar driven thing. We look at the project. We say, this is a complex project. It means a lot for our downtown. It means a lot for the North Dakota and the greater region. And we want a partner in this project who we can trust to do things right, do things safely, and bring a level of expertise to this project that'll ultimately complement what we're trying to do here with the project when it's built.
Derek, as the general manager of the general contractor who's working on this project, what are your specific responsibilities?
Well, I oversee the project as well as all of our projects. And, we hand selected a staff of project managers and superintendents to run this project. So I have an outstanding staff of people that help me. We've got two superintendents on this project, an assistant superintendent, project manager, assistant project managers, project coordinators, estimators, and a whole team of people. And we are in constant communication with Keith and the ownership group and the design team to coordinate the work and get it in place.
And how do you work with the architect? Because these are all unique structures.
Oh, sure. I mean, we are literally, on a project like this, we are talking with the architect and engineers on a daily basis on this project. We have standing weekly meetings with them, but we also have a direct line of communication with them for questions that come up to coordinate the work in the field.
Well, I have to say, as we get to watch this happening, it is a marvel of complexity in terms of all the stuff that's going on in the what is now a hole and will soon be a skyscraper. How do you schedule all this stuff?
Yeah, good question. What's unique about these projects and what people might not understand is the amount of planning and scheduling that goes into it. You know, we'll develop a very lengthy project schedule for the entire 2-year project, and we'll boil that down to daily activities. And we are talking daily about what's going on that day. We're talking weekly what's going on that week. We're talking weekly about what's coming up 6 to 8 weeks out and monitoring the progress of the schedule. What's different about a project like this is the materials and the quantity of materials that we're using. You just don't go to your local hardware store to get this stuff. It takes many, many months to coordinate, draw, order, procure the materials by the time it's on site. I'd say, on average, most of the materials, whether it's steel or precast or glass or mechanical equipment, pretty much anything here is a minimum of 3 to 4 months to get it here. So, the concrete work and the rebar and that's going into place now, we were planning that back in July and August. Most of our conversations that we're having on a daily basis now are about the structural steel that's starting in the spring and the glass that's coming next summer. So what we're talking about on a daily basis is usually what's coming 3 to 6 months down the road.
Derek Heshian is the general manager for McGough Construction, and Keith Lear is the project manager with the Kilbourne Group. And Keith, how would you describe are there day-to-day negotiations about, because it's a unique building. And I suspect that occasionally you come across something that maybe wasn't in the plan.
Yeah, we do. And, as we're going through construction, there's always things that are popping up. But to Derek's point about pre-planning this job and enough advance, we have enough of a plan or a solid enough plan so we can plan for what we do know. That allows us to help adjust and be flexible for things that we don't know. So if we come across something in a detail as it's going together, we find something as we're digging a hole and we have to get something, the conditions underground different than what we know, we have enough of an idea of where things need to be that we can be flexible. We could shift a crew to deal with that, and then ultimately we have the flexibility to be able to pick up things that are unexpected.
Well, let's start with the bottom right here, because we live in the Red River Valley, which is the bottom of an ancient lake bed, and it's clay, and it's clay for a long way down. And in the old days, I know when you put in, the supports for a big building like this, you'd have a pile driver and it'd be a hammering thing that would shake the ground for blocks around. You guys augured down. Derek, describe that process.
Sure. The burying capacity of the soil here in the Red River Valley isn't that great. Generally, any time you build a building higher than a few stories, you need to get down to what's known as the glacial till. And in this region, it's about 110 feet down until we get to that. Like you said, pile driving is one method of foundation support system. It can be loud and obnoxious and vibrate neighboring buildings.
And take a long time,
yeah. On this project, we selected an auger cast pile system. Does the same thing, but what we did is we drill the holes 110 feet deep, pull all the earth out. We set a rebar cage down in the hole, and we fill it back up with concrete. So the process of drilling in lieu of the pounding was relatively quiet and didn't cause too much disruption. So it went good on this job. We finished that process a week earlier than planned. And it went really well.
We're talking about the construction of Block 9 in the middle of downtown Fargo with Derek Heshen. He's the general manager for the general contractor, McGough Construction. And Keith Lear is the project manager with the Kilbourne Group. And how many of these holes did you have to make, these piling holes did you have to make, Derek?
There's around 368 foundation piles, and they're in groupings. They're in groupings of five or six close together, and then they'll end up being a concrete foundation on top of those, and then a column that will eventually rise to the top of the building.
Keith, Derek mentioned they got a little ahead of schedule with the making the pilings. What's the status right now?
Yeah, right now we're right on track. I think you mentioned earlier that we have about a 2-year construction period to this building's open. The ramp is on track as well. The ramp will open first, so that's the first phase to complete. We think that's still on track for a kind of a midsummer 2019 opening. They are on top of things enough scheduling, so we know exactly where we're at every day relative to the global schedule. So yeah, right now we're on track. We got a winter coming up, so we always get to play with the winter conditions and the wind in North Dakota.
But, I'd say we're there.
Yeah, right. Mild so far, but we're right on track, right where we need to be, and we're excited that we're going to finish on time.
Derek, we're on the third floor here. We have a 4-story building here that Prairie Public is in. When is our view of Broadway going to be blocked?
March. Sorry.
Okay. Well, we'll still have all of this activity to look at. Now, I remember in the old days, and I was in the Twin Cities back when the IDS Tower went up in the 70s, early 70s, and when all the steel work was done all the way to the top, they put a fir tree on top. Do you still do that?
Absolutely. We refer to that as our topping out ceremony. It signifies the last piece of structural steel on the building, and we like to celebrate that, especially if there's no injuries that occur during the project. And
well, meanwhile, we are looking at this deep hole, and Skip Wood, our producer, and I have been trying to kind of guesstimate how deep this hole is before you get to the pilings. That is, what's the bottom of the building? How far below street grade is it?
Oh, it's about 18 feet from the street down to the top of the pilings.
And what goes into the bottom of a building like this?
Well, it's a lot of concrete. So the pilings go down 110 feet, and then from there we start building concrete foundations on top of the pilings. It'll be a concrete floor 18 feet down. That'll be the basement floor. There's mechanical rooms down there and parking garage spaces down there. And then we start building the concrete columns and foundation walls, much like a house, but it's a lot larger. And we get back up to street grade and go vertical from there. What's unique about this job is it's not just a concrete building or just a steel building. It's actually a little bit of both. The main tower that rises up to the top is a concrete structure, and what we refer to as the podium, which is the first 5 stories, has a much larger footprint than the tower. It's the 3/4 of the block that Keith talked about, and that's a structural steel structure. So we're dealing with a lot of different types of materials and construction methods on this project.
And how will this building be heated and cooled, Keith?
So it has a heat pump system in it. So it's a hydronic heating system. So we have a set of boilers and some cooling towers that live at the very top of the building. So the mechanical room is at the very top of the building. Then that sends the conditioned fluid, I guess, or conditioned hydronics down the building. Then ultimately we tap into that with the heating components, which are heat pumps in this scenario, and then we can distribute and control per area of the building on those systems.
Well, I know McGough Construction has experience with very energy-efficient structures. Are there any aspects of this building that you would like to share with our listeners about that?
Yeah, so this building, we aren't trying to target like a LEED certification or anything like that, but there are some pretty sustainable things with this. We have a lot of locally sourced material, all the precast and concrete in the precast, and all the concrete in the structure are all coming, you know, within the region here. We have the fins on the side of the building actually offer some sun shading and that helps with your energy efficiency. So we have a view straight out, but then as the sun is shining on the building, it casts some shadows on the light, and that helps with our heating and cooling inside the building. And then some other things we're looking at. We're continuing to study. We have provisions for green roofs and maybe some solar in the project. So we're studying those as additional aspects to the project. Hopefully, we can continue to bring some of those in as well.
Now, when we go to big cities, you know, these skyscrapers create these kind of canyons. Fargo's going to have a little canyon now. Derek, once you get to grade and you start that steel work going up, we've noticed that you brought in a huge crane, looked like a gigantic praying mantis, to create the crane towers for the actual construction cranes. Are you lifting? How does this work? Do you lift floors? How do you do this?
No, we cast them in place. We hoist the steel with the cranes. You're right. With a high-rise tower like this and the limited constraints of a downtown setting, we'll typically use tower cranes, which are the vertical structures out there now. Very good to work with for a project like this. Like you said, we brought in a 900-ton hydraulic crane a couple weeks ago to erect the first tower crane. So we use cranes to erect other cranes, and when we're done, those cranes can actually jack themselves down and we'll dismantle them that way. So right now, the cranes on site actually aren't to their final height. They're up to their initial set height. And as we erect the steel and pour the concrete floors and build the columns and get the building up, we'll get to the point where we have to raise those tower cranes even higher, tie them back to the structure for support, and then carry the building the rest of the height.
So you use the cranes to actually increase the height of the other crane?
Right. Yep. And the concrete, we'll use pumps, from the ground, but eventually we'll get to a point where a conventional truck pump cannot reach, so we'll have slick lines and trailer-mounted pumps at the base of the building that will pump the concrete hydraulically up to the floor we're working on.
That's got to take a little oomph.
Oh, yeah.
How many people will McGough have working on this project through completion, do you think?
There'll be thousands of tradespeople, employees that will touch this building, but at any given time, I see a peak of manpower on the site of perhaps 300. Oh. Right now, we're in the 75 to 85 range in any given day, but as we get the building enclosed and bring more trades on board, like the mechanical, electrical, and glazers and things of that nature, there'll be an increase in manpower.
What's the estimate, the best estimate of the total man hours that go into something like this?
I don't know the whole job, but I know certain elements. You know, there's about 70,000 man hours in the concrete and things of that nature. So it's probably over a million.
Keith, is this the biggest thing you've worked on?
It's the most complex thing I've worked on. My career, I've worked on a couple larger projects. I was in the Minneapolis area for a while, worked on some large lab facilities at the U of M campus, had the pleasure of working on the Sanford Hospital here in Fargo. That's a pretty massive project.
Very big.
But yeah, this is just the complexity of this project in our downtown, the kind of the components and the design of the interior being, you know, it's really, you know, 5 to 7 different projects inside of one project. So there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of different design teams. So it's definitely the most complex one I've ever worked on.
And, of course, this is happening right in the middle of downtown, as we mentioned a couple of times. So lots of big equipment is coming into downtown. How is that dealt with? How do you arrange that?
Yeah, so we've been going back even before McGough was involved in the project. I mean, you know, for the better part of 2 years, we've been starting the conversations with the city, working with the city, understanding what our haul routes in and out of the site look like, where the perimeters of our sites are going to be. We attack this project, and we want to make sure people are comfortable around the project. So first and foremost is making sure the public is safe around the site, and then minimizing the impact to downtown. So there's been a lot of work on the front end working with the city to make sure they're all comfortable with these plans. Then we bring someone in like McGough and their expertise. We talk a lot about scheduling. They're making sure that their schedules are dialed in such that they can deliver They can deliver, you know, down to the hour or down to the minute, knowing when trucks are coming in and out. And we have kind of designated staging areas for trucks outside of the immediate downtown where they can stand there kind of in the queue waiting for, all right, it's my time to come deliver. So we don't have a ton of trucks piling up on the streets or anything like that. They all have designated delivery slots and an amount of time to deliver.
And, of course, we are in the winter months, so you have – and you're pouring concrete. You got to keep that kind of warm while it cures, I assume. And there are workers out there, too. So how do you do that, Derek?
Sure. Concrete construction in the winter is a difficult thing. It can be done. We use things such as heated ready mix to pour the concrete. We use ground thaw machines to keep the ground from being frozen before we pour the concrete, and then we'll typically cover and heat the concrete after it's placed until it's reached its design compressive strength. So it can be done. Takes a little more work. We do work in some rather cold temperatures, but we have our limits too. If the wind chill is getting down below zero, we'll really discuss what activities we want to do for that day. Keep people coming inside often to stay warm. Things of that nature. So high winds can shut us down too with the cranes. Wind won't blow the crane over, but you know, for hoisting things in the air that the wind could catch, we like to avoid that. So certain times the wind will keep us from using cranes. The cold temperatures and wind keep us from working outside. So we monitor the weather on a daily basis and in the wintertime and make a go or no go decision every morning and whether we're going to work that day.
Well, we have to say that part of the interest in watching something like this is to see how it's actually choreographed in that hole right now. You've got all of these cranes, some of them very, very large pieces of equipment, lots of skid steer loaders and doing various tasks down there, and of course people. So who's in charge of safety?
We have an on-site safety manager who's in charge of safety, as well as all of our craft and superintendents take a role in safety. We have daily huddles every day with all the craftspeople to talk about that day's activities and anytime the conditions change. So you're right. It's like synchronized swimming down there in the hole and a lot of things to manage. And we're just constantly talking about what the hazards are for that day and how to avoid them.
Well, one thing that really caught our eye last week and this week, as a matter of fact, was the guys going up on the towers for the cranes. That's a certain skill that not many people have, I don't think.
Well, you get used to it. There's a ship's ladder with a guard around it inside the structure of the crane, so it's perfectly safe. There's intermediate landing platforms every 20 feet, so you can stop and take a break as you go up. But
and stop a fall, too, yeah, I suppose.
This is like climbing a tower, though. You get up there, and there's about 4 feet on each side. Yeah, so...
So are there opportunities in the trades? We often talk about, you know, higher education or education past high school. It looks to me like you got lots of people working for you. Is this an industry that has opportunity for people out there looking for work?
Oh, absolutely. All of the construction trades and up to the management trades as well. I think currently the construction industry in North Dakota has the second lowest unemployment rate of anywhere in the country. So anybody in the construction industry that wants to be working is working right now.
And, are you having trouble finding people?
No. You know, we've got a good base of employees to pull from other places, so we're maintaining right now, but we are always hiring and looking for people, and there absolutely is a lot of opportunity in many different trades in the construction industry, and it's a very rewarding career, and it pays well.
Keith, if everything stays on schedule, when does Block 9 open?
So we're targeting probably late summer, fall of 2020. We'll start seeing some of the components open on the main building. Like I said earlier, the ramp, we're hoping summer, like midsummer of 2019, so about another 8-9 months on the ramp we should be open. Main tower, you know, fall of 2020, and then we're hoping the plaza is sometime kind of that in early fall, maybe early winter of 2020.
Well, the current tallest building in North Dakota was built in 1934. That's the state capitol. How long should a building like this last?
We hopefully past our lifetime. I mean, for sure past our lifetimes. You know, we would expect, you know, a 100-year building here, no problem. You know, there'll be renovations and things going on in this building for the, you know, for the foreseeable future, just because of the nature of all the things going on inside of it. But it's a solid concrete building, you know, steel building. It's durable. It's got a durable exterior to it. It's a robust system. So, you know, there's no reason it shouldn't last for a long time.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us. Keith Lear is the project manager with the Kilbourne Group. And Derek Keshian is the general manager for McGough Construction. Keith, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And Derek.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, we'll have an essay from Tom Ezern. Sue Balcom will talk about a delicacy she calls pfeffernuss, and we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Former Senator Byron Dorgan is among several ex-senators who signed an extraordinary letter that says the country is entering a, quote, dangerous period. The letter, published in the Washington Post, was signed by 44 former U.S. senators, both Democrats and Republicans. Dorgan says the letter is meant to remind Congress to put the nation's interests above politics.
We now have a president who is demonstrating through his behavior a series of things that represent what I think is a threat to the rule of law in this country in many ways. And I think the letter expresses that. It doesn't use Donald Trump's name. It just says, you know, we're in difficult times at this point, and it requires leadership from the U.S. House and U.S. Senate as part of the co-equal branch of government dealing with the president.
Dorgan says the letter was written after months of discussions about executive branch behavior that he calls, quote, well out of bounds. It was also signed by former Senator Kent Conrad, along with former Senators Tom Daschle and Larry Pressler of South Dakota and Dave Durenberger of Minnesota. In his executive budget proposal, Governor Burgum is proposing to exempt military pay and military pensions from state income taxes. North Dakota is one of a handful of states that still imposes state income taxes on the military.
I'm in the military for 20 years. I'm 42 years old. Right. I get out. I'm living in Grand Forks. I pay taxes. If I live in East Grand Forks, I don't. We have people that sign up for the military. Their first training camp is in Texas. And when they arrive, you know, their buddy goes, hey, you should switch your residency to Texas, right, because, you know, you're never going to have to pay taxes.
Burgum says he wants to attract retired military and spouses to North Dakota. He says they could help fill a number of job openings here. And Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon says he's looking at ways the Minnesota legislature could change the rules for that state's 2020 presidential primary so that voters' party preferences won't be released. Simon says he's talking to a number of local election officials as well as other voters. He says it would make sense to give some information about voters to political parties, but not make that information available to the general public.
There will be some percentage of people who will say, you know, I'd love to vote in the presidential primary, but not at the cost of having my political party preference be public. Keep in mind, Minnesota has never had party registration. We don't have that. Other states do. And this looks an awful lot like a backdoor party registration system.
Simon says the party officials have told him the information has to be collected or the parties won't recognize the primary as binding for awarding convention delegates. He also says the primary vote could be done through mail-in balloting. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you for listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern's Plainsfolk essays are a feature on our show. He combines a scholar's interest in history with writing skill and adds his own voice to share stories about the place we call home. Today, Tom's essay reminds us of the cultural diversity that distinguishes North Dakota.
Early on a Wednesday morning, I took care of some medical matters endemic to old guys. My attending physician was named Patel. I mentioned this because you'll understand shortly. From there, I drove over to the Sanctuary Events Center, where I was scheduled to address 131 new Americans taking the oath of citizenship administered by Magistrate Judge Alice Senechal. Thank you, Judge Senechal, for the invitation. I was early arriving, but the parking lot was full, as were the street spaces, so I drove into the nearby lot of the Sons of Norway and parked there. I mention this because, well, you understand by now. Today, I recount the first section of what I was privileged to say to the new citizens of the United States, all of them resident in North Dakota. Over the next 2 weeks, I will share the rest of my remarks, which were received with kind attentiveness by a packed house. Of all the states in the Federal Union, that is the United States, a nation created by immigrants, This state, North Dakota, is the most immigrant of them all. The United States Census of 1900 revealed that 78% of the people of North Dakota were born outside the United States or had parents who were born outside the United States. They were Norwegians, Swedes, Danes, Dutch, Finns, Germans, Austrians, English, Scots, Irish, Germans from Russia, Germans from Hungary, Russian, Jews, Poles, Ukrainians. Many people in that time, a century ago, said there were too many foreigners in the land, said that they would not or could not succeed in becoming Americans. Those critics were just wrong. The newcomers proved them wrong. The newcomers became new Americans. They did what you are doing today. This was not easy. Winter in North Dakota was and is hard. Making a living from the land in North Dakota was and is hard. Fitting in and getting along with the strange people all around us was and is hard. For all of us. For the newcomers, there was another difficulty. One that lived in their own hearts. The personal sorrow, the essential tragedy of their situation as human beings uprooted from their homes and transported to a place that was not home. A place that, for the original immigrant generation, perhaps never would feel like home. I stand before you today in acknowledgement of that sorrow then and now. There's an old song that came here with the Germans from Russia, many of whom sailed from the port city of Riga on the Baltic Sea. It begins this way. Die Abreis von Riga, die fällt mir so schwer, drum ade, du schönes Mädchen, wir sehen uns nimmermehr. Drum ade, du schönes Mädchen, wir sehen uns nimmermehr. The departure from Riga, the song says, makes me so sad. Farewell, my love. We will never see one another again.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up, Main Street Eats.
This time of year, while you're enjoying holiday meals and catching up, you're probably spending time with a few people you don't always agree with. But you appreciate those different perspectives. You hear them every day on NPR. Hi, I'm Tim Mack, political reporter for NPR. During this holiday season, support the station that brings us together all year round.
Make your year-end tax-deductible gift to Prairie Public by calling 800-359-4145, going online to prairiepublic.org, or text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and root seller Sue Balcom is joining us from our Bismarck microphone to talk about Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
You sent an email with some notes about what you wanted to talk about, and this one kind of looks like a cat just walked across the keyboard here. What is this word?
I have it spelled right, too. If you're not from the Tri-County area and you're not a German from Russia or Deutsch, Danish, there's a cookie that we have every Christmas, no matter what, called Pfeffernuss. And there are many, many different ways that people make them, but they're basically the same traditionally firm coffee dunking type cookie that my relatives are like knocking on my doors to have me make them for them.
Well, do you know the origin of the word? Like, do you know what this means?
It's peppernut in German. Oh, okay. And so you're thinking, yeah, that doesn't make any sense, except it does because they're very spicy and there's actually black pepper and coffee, dark coffee in the batter. And that gives them, there's just that little undernote of pepper in there when you're eating them.
And in the note, you say they become better with age.
Oh, yes. There's lots of spice in them, like ginger and cloves and cinnamon, maybe mace. There's also honey in them. and then sugar. And my recipe is like got 17 cups of flour in it. That's almost 10 pounds of flour.
Oh, geez.
So you can't possibly.
How many are you making?
Well, you can't possibly eat them all weekend long. So naturally, they're a good storage cookie. However, the main spice in there or the main flavor is anise. And so it is very prominent, and when you put them in, you don't even have to put them in the freezer. We usually keep jars of them around until about Easter time. Those flavors just seem to intensify and marry, and they're just a wonderful cookie. But I think maybe, just maybe, the reason my relatives love them all is because my grandparents made them, and they're a happy Christmas memory.
Hmm.
Okay. Sure, they're tradition then, huh?
Right,
it right. It sounds like there's a lot of potential here for this to be a great dunking cookie.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Now, there some people prefer them to be hard. I know I've bought, you know, seen the boughten ones. They are always covered with powdered sugar if you find them in the store. But I did have a friend call me up and say, those are like Russian tea cakes or Mexican tea cookies or something like that. And I said, no, we always roll ours in powdered sugar. And they're dense. And so if you can grab a cup of coffee and a couple of those, they're just amazing. They're better than an eggnog latte.
Now, you said anise is an important ingredient. There are different kinds of anise, right?
Absolutely. There's the star anise, and then there is the regular anise. The star anise is used in the five spice powder that you can find in Chinese grocery stores, but that does not work for making these cookies. The anise that we use in the cookies is actually a seed, which would be considered a spice, which is any other part of a plant than the leaves. So when it's dried, that becomes a spice. You know, seeds like anise, cumin, coriander, mustard, and those kinds. So you have to get the anise that's a seed. However, I've tried many different forms of this, like the extract and or crushing up the seed with my mortar and pestle. Nothing works as good for these cookies as the oil does. So it's hard to find that anise oil in the stores anymore. Back in the day, they used to have a rack in every drugstore you went into that had, you know, vanilla oil or cinnamon oil, those kinds of things, clove oil for making cookies. But I think since people don't bake as much, there's not as much call for it. You can find it at like places like King Arthur and Amazon. But be sure you're purchasing a food grade oil, because that way you'll be sure to get good organic ingredients for your cookies.
So is it kind of like an extract on steroids?
Well, have you ever used an essential oil like lemon or clove for flavoring? You know, it's heavier.
More so for like diffusing in rooms and stuff
right.
like that.
Right. I use mine for cooking, for crying out loud. And then that's where the smell comes from, because when you're baking, it's like amazing.
You could be a realtor, yeah.
Well, you know, that is something I used to do whenever we'd sell a house, is put a pot of soup on to cook before I left. So
yeah, that's genius.
There's something to be said about walking in a house that smells like just about anything but sauerkraut, which we made over the weekend. And sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, when is that smell ever going to go away? Oh no.
Sue, if you use 10 to 20 cups of flour for a batch of these cookies, how many are you making?
Well, let me see now. I would say approximately, they're about that big. Boy, I don't know. I've already made three batches. It's got to be at least 60 or 80 cookies, depending upon how big you're making them. They're better when they're a little bit smaller because they are so intense, like most German people you'll meet. And of course, if you don't like black licorice, I wouldn't even recommend buying any, because they have that black licorice, which is that anise flavoring.
That already sounds very good to me.
Oh my gosh, I'll have to get you some. Like I said, they're the best cookie for, like, if you have relatives in the service and you want to mail them cookies, this is the cookie you want to make, because you can't break them.
Well, you know, ginger snaps can be hard or soft. Can you soften these up?
Yes, you can. I like them when they're a little bit softer than hard as a rock. So if you don't eat them right away, which we pretty much ate all of ours right away, you can put them in a jar and take the heel of your bread, unless you're like us and fight over that part.
I do.
Okay, put a middle piece in the cookie jar, and then seal that up. And that bread will, of course, become hard as a rock, and your cookies will become softer. My mom used to do that all the time. It does.
I do that with brown sugar.
Oh, yay. Yes. That's the same concept.
Yeah.
And then, of course, this does steal some of the powdered sugar from any cookies that it's touching. But you just give them another roll in a bath of powder and they're just fine.
I want to talk about another spice that's in these cookies, because I remember the first time that I came across mace in a recipe. I sort of did a double take because, you know, I thought it was the self-defense kind of mace.
God,
it's not.
Do you love it, though?
Yes.
Love the flavor of mace.
Yeah, I had to go to an Indian market to find it.
It's really weird, too, because I think that Norwegian or Swedish breads sometimes have mace in them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's another one of my total favorites. And the only thing I know about that is that it is a spice. It is a seed. If you have a mortar and pestle, of course, buying seeds, the flavor stays better in the seed if you grind it just before you're going to use it. I actually have like nutmeg nuts, and I grate those whenever I need nutmeg, which is another one of my favorite spices at Christmas time. Eggnog and such, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would definitely you experiment a little bit with these flavors. They go well with sweet, and that's what's so good about mace and anise and, you know, not cumin, of course, but, what's the other big one?
Cinnamon, ginger.
So there's a little cinnamon in this cookie recipe, too. But anyway, just try them sometimes. They're really awesome. But buy the seed if you can, or I think Penzi spices are probably the freshest on the market that people around here are familiar with.
Well, we check in with Root Cellar Sue once a week, at least on Main Street. And if you have a question,
you can send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
Or you could visit my website at rootcellars.com. We'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, announcing their 12th annual special edition ornament, this year one-of-a-kind spearfishing decoys made by Rick Whittier of Lidgerwood, North Dakota. Go to nd.gov/arts or the North Dakota Heritage Center gift shop.
Oh, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Well, every Thursday, that's the question we ask around here, and Christine McClellan and I have been looking at the calendar. We've got a few ideas, Christine.
Yes, it's a lot of Christmas stuff, but that's this time of year. So first off, we have Christmas with the Comstocks. This is going to be at the Comstock House in Moorhead on Saturday, December 15th from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Celebrate a Victorian Christmas at the historic Comstock House, which will be decorated for the holidays. Guests can explore the traditions of a Victorian Christmas by learning about the Christmas customs of the Comstock family and their friends. Play Victoria parlor games, learn local history, and discover the origin of today's holiday traditions. There's also going to be live Christmas music from the Moorhead High School Christmas Carolers at 5 p.m. and the Concordia Flute Choir at 6 p.m. So this is $9 for adults, $8 for seniors, $7 for kids, and free for college students and members.
Well, after a frigid November and early December, things have warmed up a bit. So let's talk about the Bold St. Nick's Fat Bike Race. It's in Medora. It's on December 15th. You can brave the cold for the third annual Bold St. Nick's Fat Bike Race in North Dakota's rugged Badlands. You can enjoy the Matahe Trail against a wintry backdrop as you wind and weave your fat bike across some of the toughest and prettiest terrain in North Dakota. And you can find out more about this experience at experienceland.org. And then there'll be a way to select the Bold St. Nick's Fat Bike Race.
The Grand Forks Central Theater is presenting the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. This is going to be Thursday, December 13th through Saturday, December 15th at 7 p.m. each night at the Grand Forks Central Black Box Theater. This musical is about an eclectic group of six mid-pubescents vying for the spelling championship of a lifetime. While candidly disclosing hilarious and touching stories from their home lives, the tweens spell their way through a series of words, hoping never to hear the soul-crushing, pout-inducing, life-unaffirming ding of the bell that signals a spelling mistake. Six spellers enter and one speller leaves. $10 for adults or $6 for students and seniors.
The Whoever Can Come Band will be hosting a free and open to all Christmas jam session at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City from 1 to 4 on Saturday. That's December 15th. You can bring an instrument and come play along. And for information, you can contact Wes Anderson. He's always our connection for the Whoever Can Come Band, and we thank him for that. It's this Saturday from 1 to 4 at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City.
There's an old-fashioned Christmas in Drayton, North Dakota. This is their annual Christmas event with food, open houses, Tree of Lights program, music, horse-drawn sleigh rides, crafters market, Santa, a curling bonspiel, and much more. This is Thursday, December 13th through Saturday, December 15th, just at various locations around Drayton, North Dakota, and it's free to attend.
The FM Ballet is doing that holiday classic, The Nutcracker, in Fargo, and that runs Saturday and Sunday. Experience the joys of a live dance performance and support local dancers and musicians as the FM Ballet dances to the Wonderland Orchestra's live rendition of Tchaikovsky's classic suite of The Nutcracker. Again, more information about this at fmballet.org.
There's the Zodiac Planetarium Show. This is at the Rhodes Science Center at Valley City State University. This is a free planetarium show on Saturday, December 15th at 1 p.m. The Zodiac is a fun look at the stories surrounding the 12 zodiacal constellations that fall along the ecliptic plane over the course of the year. These ancient signs have been associated with astrology and are directly related to the early vestiges of astronomy. This 30-minute program, suitable for all ages, examines these constellations and the stories of ancient gods and heroes associated with them. So that's the Zodiac Planetarium Show this Saturday.
True North Theater is presenting Jacob Marley's Christmas Carol at the High Prairie Art and Science Complex in Bismarck. The performances are 7:30 Thursday through Saturday and a matinee performance of 2 o'clock on Sunday. That's December 16th. It's adapted into a stage play from the novel. Writer Tom Mula gives us a poignant tale with more than a dash of wit, telling the story of a Christmas carol from a new perspective. Jacob Marley, who is dead, this new family-friendly fare is as if Charles Dickens and Douglas Adams had decided, Hitchhiker to the Galaxy, I guess, had decided to collaborate on a holiday ghost story, and you will never look at these classic characters in quite the same way again. Tickets are $16 to see Jacob Marley's Christmas Carol at the High Prairie Art and Science Complex in Bismarck. What's your pick?
My pick, I thought this sounded very fun, is the Santa Fly-In at the Fargo Air Museum. That's this Saturday, December 15th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Santa is going to fly in on a helicopter and arrive at 10 a.m. at the Fargo Air Museum, then visit with children about their Christmas lists, and then leave at 1 p.m. And then during that whole time, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Santa's elves will be helping children in and out of a couple special airplanes so kids can look around. So it's $8 for adults, $7 for students, seniors, and veterans, $5 for kids, and free for children under 5.
And mine is the Canadian Pacific Holiday Train. It'll be in Hankinson and Enderlin December 14th. Carrington, Harvey, Minot, and Kenmare on Saturday the 15th. It's that time of year when the Canadian Pacific's holiday train passes through North Dakota, bringing holiday joy and music with it. It's your chance to enjoy entertainment by Willie Porter, Trues, Sam Roberts Band, and JoJo Mason. The lighted holiday train collects food and donations to support local food banks, so take in the Canadian Pacific holiday train. And that's what's happening.
Hi, I'm Bill Thomas, Director of Radio here at Prairie Public, reminding you that we are a non-commercial, non-profit, statewide radio network and online stream that delivers so much high-quality programming and fact-based independent journalism, and that we rely on listeners like you to help pay for it. In this most wonderful time of the year, when we're all brimming with generosity, we're asking you to be kind to your neighbors, your friends, family, co-workers, and Prairie Public. You can make a tax-deductible contribution of any amount at prairiepublic.org, or you can call 800-359-4145 or text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link we send. I want to wish you and everyone listening a very happy holiday season.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 13th. Perhaps no one has as many places in North Dakota named for themselves as Judson Lemoore. Political boss Alexander McKenzie comes close with two towns and one county, but Judd Lemoore has him beat. Lemoore was a Dakota territorial lawmaker whose name is in Lemoore County and the towns of Judd, Judson, and Lemoore. Lemoore was born in 1839 in Quebec and came to Dakota Territory in 1860 after time in Iowa and the goldfields of Colorado. He farmed in Union County in southern Dakota, worked for a transportation business, and was also a sub-agent for the Lower Brule Reservation. In 1870, he moved to Pemmata County in far northeastern North Dakota, where for decades he owned a mercantile business at Nitchie. Lemoore was also a politician, serving in the legislature a record 16 terms from 1872 to 1911. That included two terms in the Dakota Territorial House of Representatives, two terms in the Territorial Council, and 12 terms in the North Dakota State Senate. He was also on the Dakota Territorial Board of Railroad Commissioners for an appointed term in 1889 and even did duty as a U.S. Deputy Marshal for many years. Lemoore was just 34 years old when Lemoore County was created and named for him in 1873. The county's only town at the time was Grand Rapids, which became the county seat by default. In 1882, the town of Lemoore incorporated, and on this date that year, the town's post office was established. In 1884, after a bitter contest with Grand Rapids, Lemoore won an election to wrest away the county seat. Today, Grand Rapids is no longer incorporated. Also in Lemoore County is Judd, a railroad town south of Jamestown, renamed in Lemoore's honor in 1906 after two name changes. Then there's Judson, North Dakota, a ghost town west of Mandan. It was named in 1901 after its siting along the Northern Pacific Railroad. Interestingly enough, Lemoore's father-in-law was a prominent namesake too, Nelson E. Nelson of Nelson County fame. On another note, Judson Lemoore's name also found a home on the high seas as the United States Navy commissioned two tank landing ships named for the county. They were in service at different times, but both were christened the USS Lemoore County. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Noelle King. Over the past year, you listened as news broke and developed. You kept up with it all because being informed is important to you. And maybe as the stories changed, you did too. You heard new angles and voices, you understood, you grew. There will be more to learn in the new year, and we'll explore it all together. So please make a year-end gift now, because when we grow, you do too.
Help Prairie Public grow by making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Call 800-359-4145, go to prairiepublic.org, or text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
And for those of you who have done that, thank you very much. You know, earlier this week we had a match that people met. And those people who became members or who renewed their membership, well, they're making Main Street and Prairie Public possible, and we can't thank you enough for that. We hope we've made some friends as well as members. Coming up tomorrow on Main Street, the North Star chapter of Germans from Russia has published Watermelons and Thistles. It has essays and poems about growing up in North Dakota with that Germans from Russia heritage. And tomorrow we'll talk about the project with Carol Just. News Director Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly discussion of the headlines, and Matt Olin will review another new movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me? We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.